This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. China is working to increase its global power by expanding world trade. One dramatic way that it's doing that is by resurrecting the historic Silk Roads trade routes with Europe. In our first segment, trumpet writer Richard Palmer will help you to understand the geopolitical and prophetic significance of this effort. Britain's decision to get out of the European Union really turned financial markets on their head. Investors are panicking over what is going to happen next. Trumpet writer Robert Morley is going to help us understand why and what to expect in the time ahead. The world's top state sponsor of terror is Iran. We're going to look at its activities not in Iraq or Syria or anywhere in the Middle East, but what it's doing in Argentina and elsewhere in South America. This past Saturday, Holocaust survivor and author Elie Wiesel died. We're going to talk about some of his accomplishments and a recent warning he gave that we would do well to remember. And I'll conclude today's show by talking about your family's most important textbook. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. The global economy has been ruled by America for several decades, but that is about to change. There are several nations working to topple the existing economic order, and among them, one of the most aggressive is China. The Chinese are undertaking a whole lot of initiatives to make this happen. We're going to talk about one in particular, the resurrection of a very historically significant trade route called the Silk Roads. This is an initiative that would connect two-thirds of the world's population in trade between Asia and Europe. It's being rebuilt right now, and it has some tremendous implications in the fulfillment of biblical prophecy. And to talk about some of these, we have trumpet writer Richard Palmer via Skype from our office in Britain. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
You talked about this on the Trumpet Daily radio show a couple of weeks back, but this is really significant. Help us to understand why this is something that people should really be interested in.
Well, ultimately, this is about world domination. It's it's about why is America top dog right now? Why not only does America dominate economically, culturally, America's culture is undoubtedly preeminent all around the world. Before then, it was Britain. Britain was top dog. And, English is the world's second language, the most common second language spoken all around the world. Why is it this way? And it's the way that it is. A major reason it's that way is because America and then Britain before her controlled the arteries of global trade. And then you start taking this back further in history and you see exactly the same pattern. Before the days of Britain and America, Spain and Portugal controlled a lot of naval trade, and they were top dogs. That was the time of the Habsburg Empire, and they controlled vast amounts of the world. That was their golden age. Before then, you have the vast majority or the main artery of global trade were the Silk Roads running through Central Asia. And where were all the world's kind of big empires back then? They were all around Central Asia. You had the Mongols going back further. You had the Persians and you had various other. Between then, you had some Muslim empires. Then you also had even the Roman Empire and the Byzantine Empire. The Roman Empire reached quite far into that area. They controlled Palestine. They controlled Egypt and had a lot of influence and had a great involvement on these trade roads. So you see control of global trade goes hand in hand with empire and world domination. And so when we see China now looking at control of global trade, trying to make sure that its trade is under its control. All of mankind's history tells us empire, global domination go right along with that.
Now, we've talked quite a lot about the moves that China is making in order to control sea trade routes and the procuring of ports all over the world, securing its control over the South China Sea and several maritime trade routes. And it seems like in a modern economy, that really is what would put a country in pole position in terms of trade, because so much moves by water now, whereas it much more than it would have historically, say, when the Silk Roads were in their prime. But why is this significant now? We're talking about overland routes between China and Europe. Maybe you can just help to put that into context in terms of its significance to China today.
Well, there's a number of reasons. I mean, one of the theories that we study international relations class here at college is the world island theory put forward by a British geographer called Mackinder. And the way he saw the world writing 100 years ago, he was kind of the founder of geopolitics, of looking at international relations through the lens of geography. And people like Robert Kaplan, people like George Friedman are kind of the academic descendants of his way of viewing the world. And he put great stock in the rise of railways and the ability of railway to completely transform Central Asia. And you see that within the history of the United States. At the founding of the United States, a lot of people genuinely believed that, you know, the United States would become several countries, or the continent would be split, and the United States would just be a small part of this whole continent, because, you know, nobody had envisioned of one country spanning that much territory before. The railway made that possible. It made it possible, this major change in the United States, a country that truly does span a continent. And so Mackinder, looking on 100 years out from that, was arguing, well, it could change Central Asia as well. And he made a whole number of these points 100 years ago, just about how rail does have the very much a speed edge over sea travel. And then that's even more relevant in the context now of modern manufacturing, of just-in-time manufacturing, which is the way so many factories operate. It also enables transportation of perishable goods, you know, foods. You couldn't ship those via sea before then. And then it's also it allows China to diversify. It allows China to have another option. During World War II, Japan came in, quite easily took the area along China's coasts. The nation then was locked out of trade. It could only get in reinforcements that were sent in via air in a very dangerous route by the U.S. Air Force mostly. And so by having an overland trade route, they're trying to expand their options now. China, because of its dependence on sea trade, it's kind of been an island despite it being part of Asia. And so by putting in all of these overland routes, they're radically changing their own geography almost, and they're making it possible so that a sea power cannot cut them off. And so it just radically transforms the way that all of Central Asia then operates to each other, where wealth flows around. And then, as showed at the start, the direction and the channels in which wealth flow determine where power flows and where power goes. And the other important thing about the Silk Roads as well is that they connect largely Asia and Europe, China and Europe. And so a shift to overland trade routes in Central Asia, it was going to marks a shift of the whole global economy towards China and Europe, both in terms of a practical push in that direction, but also kind of a statement of intent, a demonstration that Europe and China intend to trade much more with each other because they're investing in those links.
And it does seem like this really is a deliberate effort to overthrow the status quo of an American-dominated economy. And maybe we can just talk about some specifics in terms of the investment, the infrastructure that's being put into place right now in order to make this happen.
Right. It is a huge investment. China has committed $1 trillion to this project. That's a vast amount of money. That's about eight times the size of the Marshall Plan that America put into rebuilding Europe after World War II. That's that's a world-changing sum of money.
And what are some of the projects that is going to create now?
Well, one lecturer at Yale said that this has the potential just to transform the world just as much as the Marshall Plan did. And if you look at the impact that had, you know, rebuilding Europe as a major power from the dust of World War II. And so within Central Asia, you know, there are new cities that have sprung up, a new capital city even, just within the last 20 years. These rail links for the most part, during the Cold War between China and Europe, they didn't exist. They're being built from nowhere. And already a lot of that has changed. There's a 7,000-mile-long rail link now that runs between China and a major export center in China all the way over to Germany. And there are trains half a mile long, you know, carrying things like computers. I think even cars now between China and Germany in this German city, Duisburg, has apparently become kind of known as Chinatown from all of this trade. And so it is leading to this real boom in trade between Europe and China. Hamburg is the second busiest port within Europe. And that has received the trade with China has increased now to the point that one in every three containers in Hamburg is from China. And we're talking about over land and rail. As part of this same kind of investment project, China is also trying to make sure that the maritime trade between Europe and China is brought under their control, that they have sea gates, that they have ports that stretch from China to Europe so that a naval power wouldn't be able to cut that off. In the past, it was referred to as the string of pearls, in that the idea being that there's all these stops that China controls along the route. Now it's being called the Maritime Silk Road. So they're really pushing so that all the infrastructure is in place so that you could have really robust trade between China and Europe.
This is you're working on a major feature article for The Trumpet on this, and it has a whole lot of ramifications, just geopolitically, but also from a standpoint of Bible prophecy. What would you say would be, far more than we can talk about in the next 4 or 5 minutes, but what would you say is one of the more interesting or more significant, prophetically important parts of this story?
Well, the one that immediately jumps out at me is in Isaiah 23 talks about a mart of nations. And it makes very clear this whole chapter, it's a trading relationship. It's talking about merchants growing rich. It's talking about ships full of various different treasures traveling off. And if you look at what that talks about prophetically, it's a mart of nations that includes Europe and it includes China. You know, the two powers that are at either end of the Silk Road. And Mr. Flurry started talking about this, I think, somewhere around 2010. This was several years before the Silk Roads initiative really got underway in the way that we see it today. And it was almost immediate, in about the 3 or 4 years after that, trade between China and Germany just exploded. So it was just a very dramatic evidence of Bible prophecy, even already, even in just the changes that we've seen over these last 5 years. And if you look at what China is doing with this Silk Road, it really is a mart of nations. You know, one of the big goals they have is to increase the use of their currency abroad. And then at the same time as they're building all this infrastructure, they've also set up the Asia Infrastructure and Investment Bank as an alternative to the World Bank. And it's about drawing, and they've drawn in other Asian nations. But then Europe has gotten very heavily involved in this AAIIB. And so this is kind of like a multilateral economic project, very much in line with this mart of nations. And then it's about it boosting trade, buying and selling together. And there's a very strong economic relationship that is going and being built alongside with all of these railway lines and ports. And it's just a dramatic fulfillment already of what's in the Bible.
Just to circle back to a point that you made at the beginning, that it is trade and dominance of trade routes that tends to empower an empire. Maybe you can just put this into broader context. What is it about this mart of nations and the relationship between Europe and Asia that really gives it significance in the bigger picture of prophecy? And how should we expect to see this unfold, this relationship in terms of world power?
Well, if control of the trade routes goes hand in hand with empire, as America loses control of trade routes, the very logical prediction is that they will lose control of their empire, that the American dominance will now shift away to this Europe and China, in the same way that the dominance of Portugal and Spain shifted away from them at once. Britain started to control the international trade routes, and it declines because they without this strong trade base, the economy just dries up. They end up having massive debt problems. That happened to Imperial Spain. We see that happening to America today. But then, controlling these trade routes means physically controlling bits of territory, physically controlling ports, railway lines. I quote in this article from a book called The Silk Roads, A New History of the World by Peter Frankopan. And one point he makes in the conclusion of this really review of all of global history from the perspective of the Silk Roads, he writes, as late as the mid-20th century, it was possible to sail from Southampton, London, or Liverpool to the other side of the world without leaving British territory. Today, it is the Chinese who can do something similar. And so in controlling these Silk Roads, they're controlling real power. And between Europe and China, they're getting to the point very soon where they'd just be able to completely cut America out of the trading system. And that's exactly what Bible prophecy says will happen. And if you look at where America, how America, dependent America is upon trade, it depends upon it for wealth, but even just the essentials of modern living. And so being able to cut America off from these gives these nations a huge amount of power. And Bible prophecy says that that's power they'll absolutely use to make sure that the global dominance does shift from America over to them.
So many of these prophecies that you're talking about, they're almost, it's hard to even wrap your mind around just how different, how radically different the fulfillment of these is from what we see today. And it seems to me like the facts that you're bringing out in this article that you're working on really give us some tangible evidence of the fulfillment of some of these things, that you can start to fill in the details and see how a step would lead to another step to these dramatic changes. Really something that our readers and our listeners need to watch closely. I think this does an outstanding job of bringing some of these facts to light in a way that really does make it more real to us. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer. He's working on an article. The working title of it at this point is All Roads Lead to Beijing. I think this is going to be a major feature article in the next issue of The Trumpet, which will be out in a while. But please do keep attuned to thetrumpet.com for this article. And Richard, we really appreciate the research that you're putting into this and look forward to seeing the results.
Great. Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Ever since Britain voted to leave the European Union on June 23rd, global markets have been extremely volatile. Investors are uncertain. This really was a blow to the trend toward globalization that has defined the world economy for quite a long time now. Where might this lead? How serious is this? What can we expect to happen next? I have trumpet writer Robert Morley here to talk about those questions. Hello, Robert.
Hi, good to be here.
So bring us up to speed. What's been happening with the world economy since Britain made this decision?
Well, in one word, I would describe it as volatile. There has been a lot of movement, a lot of uncertainty. Probably, if there's a better word, it would be uncertain. Volatile and uncertain, probably the two keywords impacting markets today across the board. Following the Brexit vote, markets plunged. Everywhere you looked, it was a sea of red. There was the only thing that was up that day, I think, was the U.S. dollar, as investors sought any refuge outside of Europe and outside of the U.K. and gold. But across the line, everything else was down. Every market you look at, S&P 500 index, even in America, I think that was down its biggest day ever, at least one of the biggest days in its entire history. But as bad as it was in America, in Europe, it was even worse. If you look at, the German DAX index, it crashed that day, has been crashing since, has not recovered. If you look at currencies, probably the carnage is even more pronounced. The UK pound, I think yesterday or else it was this morning, I just caught a headline. It said it had reached the lowest level in 31 years. So it has been basically, it plunged the day of the vote. Markets were caught off guard. The analysts got it wrong. And since then, it has kept falling. It has not recovered at all. The euro, basically the same way. It has steadied up a little bit. But even as of last week, it was still plummeting from that fall. So investors around the world have taken this very negatively. We saw trillions of paper wealth vanish over the next couple of days after Brexit, and that hasn't returned yet.
They're always looking for certainty and stability and trying to find any kind of a refuge for the money that they move around. What are some of the concerns? Is obviously a lot of people looking at this situation, not quite sure how this is going to break or how things will settle out. But what are some of the possibilities that really have them concerned and troubled?
Well, I think there's two things, and they both sort of hinge around trade. Britain's position with Europe has often been as a gateway for America into the European Union. And now that's being threatened. So not only is Britain's ability to trade with Europe up in question, you know, what's going to happen? When Britain leaves, do we get to keep the same trade rules? How will they be changed? How will they be modified? But also, not only is it concerning Britain, but it's all these big U.S. corporations that go through Britain to get access to the European Union. And that's all up in the air as well. Nobody knows what does this mean. And in that kind of climate, all these big companies are now putting on the brakes and saying, we just need to hold off and wait and see what happens. So plans of expansion are put on hold. U.S. corporations, when they're looking at Britain now, they might be more inclined to say, well, why don't we just avoid the uncertainty of dealing with Britain altogether, and let's just open up headquarters or move our operations to Frankfurt or Paris or wherever it is, and just bypass the U.K. altogether. And then there's just the uncertainty involved with, could this escalate between Europe and Britain? And we don't know, because there has been a lot of rhetoric.
Yeah, so a lot of European leaders were making some pretty strong statements in the wake of this vote, saying that we need to punish Britain. But there is also just trade realities and what is really in the best interest of European nations. I mean, obviously, Britain's financial clout has been massive. What's the best decision for them? I guess that's what investors want to know.
Well, that's a great question. The UK is something like the fifth or sixth largest economy in the world. So this is no small issue for the European Union. European Union being the biggest economy in the world when you add up all the economies within Europe. And there has been a lot made about this. I think Britain's exports to the EU are somewhere in the range of $305 billion per year. And then Britain also imports from the EU about $388 billion. So a lot of people have looked at this and said, look, Britain is importing a lot more from Europe than it's exporting. So Europe has to go easy on Britain, because they don't want to lose Britain, because they're going to lose this important trade partner.
Well, Nigel Farage made that point when he talked to the European Commission or the European Parliament afterward. He said that, it would be easy for Europe to have this kind of cutting off its nose to spite its face approach. And he really said, look, let's be adults. Let's talk about this realistically, what's going to be best for both sides.
That's right. And in a completely rational, logical, unemotional world, that's what you would expect. You would hope that these actors would come together and say, hey, we don't want, we want to work out what's best economically, financially, for everybody. But the reality is, we also live in a world where there's also emotion involved, there's geopolitics involved, there's a whole lot of other factors. So, for example, following the outvote, Francois Hollande, France's prime minister, he came out and said, look, now that Britain has voted to leave, there's no reason why Europe needs its financial capital to be in Britain. That needs to be moved over to the continent. Do you think Britain's going to let that go? Just going to throw up its hand and say no? It's going to fight tooth and nail for that. I mean, that is the most important industry for Britain. Francois Hollande knew that. He knew that that would be fighting words for Britain. He knew that would stir up huge reaction in London. And yet he still came out and said that. France's former prime minister came out and said, we need to work to move the financial industry out of London into Europe. So these sorts of things that we've been talking about are not going to be cut and dry. There's going to be a lot of negotiations. It's going to get very emotional. It's going to be very heated. And the question is, know, how far is it going to go? And then we can put this in context of falling currencies and put this in context of trade, the pound plummeting, the euro plummeting. We're going to see a lot more rhetoric from politicians talking about protecting jobs. You know, when the pound falls in the UK, well, guess what? Suddenly, European manufacturers are having a harder time competing against British manufacturers. So we're going to see a lot more rhetoric on the continent, even in places from Germany, saying, hey, we need to start protecting our industry from the British because the pound is falling so much, you know, because of this. So I think it's going to be a lot more complicated than, you know, Nigel Farage perhaps let people know when he was campaigning.
The best case scenario that the Leavers were hoping.
Absolutely. And this does have, these kind of things have the potential to get ugly.
Very interesting to watch, I guess, the smorgasbord of possibilities before us exactly how this might play out. It's not difficult to see why investors would be jittery right now. But what's interesting is looking at this in light of the overview of biblical prophecy that we understand that Britain is done for, you know, in terms of world power. It's not going to reclaim any power that it once had. And meanwhile, it also tells us that Europe is really going to become an economic powerhouse like the world really hasn't seen. So exactly how things go from where we are to where the Bible says they're going, it'll be interesting to see that develop.
Yeah, absolutely. Divorces, which is what's happening in Europe now, are rarely clean, and they have the potential to get very, very ugly. But as you said, the long-term picture for England is much lower, reduced power, reduced standard of living, less financial clout, less economic clout than it has today, whereas the opposite is true for Europe. So going forward, as you said, Bible does make that clear. We're expecting much more economic strength out of Europe in the future. What exactly that looks like, we'll just have to wait and see. But we do know the direction and the trends that it's going.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Robert Morley, trying to make sense of the economic picture post-Brexit. Interesting to watch, and hopefully you can write something up about this in the time ahead. People could watch for that on thetrumpet.com. But we do appreciate your time, Robert.
It's my pleasure.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Despite the fact that the Western world just concluded a deal with Iran regarding its nuclear program, the Islamic Republic of Iran remains the world's number one state sponsor of terrorism. And we tend to be fairly familiar with a lot of its activities in the Middle East, in Iraq and Syria and Israel and elsewhere there. But its activities stretch far beyond that region. They go right up to really America's back door in Latin America. Trumpet writer Anthony Chibadewe is here to talk about this. Hello, Anthony.
Hello.
So tell us, what is some of the recent activity, some of the recent evidence that we've seen of Iran's activity in this part of the world?
Iran has been infiltrating South America for years now. I guess the most significant example of its infiltration of Latin America was back in 1994 when Iranian terrorists bombed a Jewish community center in Argentina, in the capital city. That attack killed 85 people and wounded more than 300 people. To this day, it's the worst terrorist attack in Argentina, and there have been a lot of other incidences like that in Latin America, but not quite as big as this. They've been working on it, investigating it, and of course, Iran has been working to distance itself from that investigation, meddling in the investigation process. And Argentina has been trying to stay on top of that investigation. They appointed a prosecutor to work on that terrorist attack. But that prosecutor, his name was Alberto Nisman. I say was because he was killed. He was murdered just 4 days after he had filed a complaint against the Argentine government for working with the Iranians, trying to distance Iran, trying to whitewash Iran's involvement in that terrorist attack. And it was also just one day before he was scheduled to testify before the Argentine Congress about that cover-up.
And when did that happen?
This was in January 2015.
An attack that happened over 20 years ago, but this guy was killed and in what looks pretty shady just a year and a half ago.
Yes, this case has been stalled. There have been a lot of roadblocks along the way. But now you have a man who's really coming close, after about 22 years, to point the finger at Iran and bring out the evidence of Iran's involvement in this. And there's a report that was published by Joseph Umira. He works at the Center for a Secure Free Society. And he based his report on what this prosecutor has been collecting over the years, the wiretaps, the intelligence reports that he has been collecting. And he has essentially been sort of picking up from him. And he found a lot of compelling evidence of Iran's infiltration of Latin America and how Iran has benefited the most from the death of this prosecutor.
So what is some of the other evidence? We're talking about an attack that happened 22 years ago. We're talking about assassination that could have Iranian fingerprints on it, although I don't know how much proof there is of that. It just seems like circumstantial proof. But what other evidence is there of Iran's infiltration in Latin America? Where and how far does it go? If you've got Argentina, where else are they involved?
This report that I referenced, it's really intriguing, and I'd like to encourage our readers to read it, because it details a lot of Iran's involvement in Latin America, how Iran set up its embassy in Spain to be the primary embassy to communicate and coordinate Iran's activities in Latin America, its terrorist activities, terrorist network in Latin America. They were mostly controlled at the embassy in Spain, which makes more sense considering that Spain has a lot more connections with Latin America. But all of those activities, or most of them, were directed from Spain. And in Latin America, they were coordinating with other Iranian embassies in Latin American countries, from Argentina to Brazil, Colombia. And the report details a lot of those. There was one particular Iranian agent who works for the current supreme leader, who has been coordinating with a lot of those embassies in Latin America and also working with some Hezbollah operatives in those countries. Some of the nations that they've worked with: Brazil, like I mentioned, Colombia, Venezuela, Chile, Uruguay, Cuba, and Mexico. So they have been using their embassies and using all the fine diplomatic covers, even cultural covers, commercial covers, setting up businesses in Latin America. Some of them that I mentioned in the report, a beef business. They set up a business for importing beef from Argentina, beef which Iran really doesn't need that much. One of the Iranian agents who worked there, he worked as a cover as a beef inspector. His main job was to coordinate these terrorist activities in Iran.
So a lot of this, it looks like legitimate activity. It looks like business, trade, economic deals, diplomatic relationships. But the evidence of terrorism, that they're actually sponsoring terrorism, I mean, are we seeing the terrorist attacks in Latin America? And if so, what are the Iranians trying to accomplish through that?
There's a company, it's called Iran Shipping Lines. It has been under sanctions for helping Iran with its nuclear program, its missile, ballistic missile program. It has been under sanctions for that. It was directly implicated in the 1994 attack. And now, since the nuclear deal, it's no longer under sanctions. So there is abundant evidence of Iran infiltrating Latin America, and it's part of its purpose to radicalize Latin America and even diminish America's influence and Israel's influence in Latin America.
So it is trying to, say, recruit interest in the same kind of revolution, the same kind of radical Islam that it's trying to gain elsewhere in the Middle East. There was actually a report sometime back of Cuban fighters in Syria who were collaborating with Russian soldiers there. Is there evidence of the success, how much success Iran is having in terms of recruiting for its cause from Latin America?
You have a lot of Hezbollah operators in Latin America, all the way up to Mexico. Hezbollah has been cooperating with a lot of Mexico's drug cartels, dealing in the narcotics business. That's been one of the big sources of their income, aside from what Iran pays out. And Iran has been, like you mentioned Cuba, it has been taking advantage of some of those rogue states that are anti-American, anti-European, and they are socialist nations, most of them, and they don't have the best economies, so they would be a lot more susceptible to Iran giving them petrodollars for any of the favors that he might want in that region. So that has been the case, especially if you look at a nation like even Argentina, Venezuela under Hugo Chavez. Iran has had a really strong influence with those countries. So there has been a lot of success.
Well, we've talked a whole lot more about Europe's infiltration, Europe's influence in Latin America, cultural ties, the strong Catholic influence in South America, and just how ripe that makes them for exploitation by Europeans, or certainly creating a lot of ties that could have dramatic implications in the entire Western Hemisphere. The fact that Iran would be as active as it is, it seems like that would really be something that would give the Europeans a great deal of concern. We talked about other, say, states within the Middle East and activities that Iran has is engaged in the Middle East that are really can be viewed as a provocation against Europe. This seems like another provocative act on Iran's part.
Certainly. And just to make the point, we can just use Argentina just as an example, because Argentina, as we've been talking about, he has had these close ties with Iran. That has been primarily under the Kirchner administrations, both Nestor Kirchner and Cristina Kirchner. Iran has been able to cooperate a lot more with that government. But Kirchner was just recently replaced by a president who is a little more pro-European than Kirchner was, and of course a little more anti-Iran than Kirchner was. So that's Europe would see that as a positive change. You've had these countries who have had closer ties with Iran, and now you're seeing a little bit of a change. Not just in Argentina, there've been similar developments with Brazil. Even in the report, it talks a lot about how Iran has cooperated with Brazilian authorities there to spread its influence. But there's been a little bit of a change in the governance in Argentina because of the Rousseff scandal. So you're seeing a little bit of change with regimes moving a little bit away from Iran and maybe closer to Europe, and that's something that Europe is going to want to take advantage of, because Iran has had a lot of success under those rogue regimes. Venezuela is another example. It has been very instrumental in spreading that influence especially under Hugo Chavez's administration. And now you're beginning to see things change a little bit in Venezuela, and you'd think that Europe would want to take advantage of that because it's better off limiting Iran's influence in Latin America and trying to turn it more toward Europe. So I'm sure it's very concerned about the success Iran has had in Latin America, and I'm sure they would want to do something to stop it.
Well, we definitely expect tensions between Iran and Europe to increase, and it will be interesting to see what kind of a role activities in Latin America might play into that. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Anthony Chibatawe. He's working on an article on this subject you can watch for on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate your time, Anthony.
Good to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour.
This past Saturday, Elie Wiesel died. He's a Jewish Nobel laureate who survived the Holocaust after spending time in Auschwitz and Buchenwald during the Second World War. I have trumpet writer Andrew Miller here to talk about him. Give us a sense of who this man was.
Yeah, Elie Wiesel was just a really famous figure over the course last half of a century. Even President Barack Obama had termed him the conscience of the world. He's the man who immortalized the phrase "never again" in reference to the Holocaust. As a teenager, he was imprisoned in a concentration camp in Poland, where both his mother and his sister died. Him and his father were transferred to Buchenwald later, and then where they were liberated by the American Third Army. And though his father died of malnutrition only a few months after that.
And it was really his experience in those two concentration camps that formed the foundation of his novel Night, which is what he received the Nobel Prize for.
Yes, because I mean, for the first few years after the war, like most Holocaust survivors, it wasn't something he really wanted to talk about. Although later on he kind of came in that he said he kind of had a duty to testify to this. This is one of the quotes from him. He said, "If I survived, it must be for some reason. I must do something with my life." So he wrote this book, Night, which is now almost required reading on the Holocaust in many college and high school level classes. One of the most famous advocates against genocide, like I said, he immortalized that phrase, "never again," and he really spoke out against the various genocides in like Rwanda and other parts of Africa and Yugoslavia, and then even more recently became a huge supporter of the resistance movement against the mullahs in Iran. Even as late as the Iraq War, there had been camps or cities of like Sunni settlers in Iraq that had been attacked and had people massacred by front groups for the Iranian regime, that he was one of the big advocates, just really drawing attention that, no, this is approaching genocide levels in these areas, and this is being sponsored by the Iranian government, and the world can't afford to just look the other way like so many nations did in the earlier years of the Holocaust.
So that really did end up being his what he devoted his life to, was essentially speaking up on behalf of those who were enduring similar circumstances to those that he had gone through himself.
Right. It started out with this book Night, with drawing attention to the Holocaust and definitely serving as a witness to try to fight against those who are Holocaust deniers, who try to claim that it never happened, as someone who obviously was very well aware that it had happened and had experienced the majority of it. And then just trying to really be an advocate. Like I said, President Obama had even called him at one point the conscience of the world, trying to just draw attention to these atrocities around the globe.
So you say that he was friends with President Obama, but he had pretty strong opposition to what a lot of people consider to be one of the signature achievements of the Obama presidency.
Right. Yeah, I think President Obama first heard Mr. Wiesel speak when he was still a the president was still a student in college, but they developed a little closer of a relationship after 2009. But they really did have one big area of divergence that started coming into play around 2013, which was the Iranian nuclear deal. Obviously, as a supporter of the Iranian resistance and a great friend of Israel's, Elie Wiesel was very concerned that a nuclear-armed Iran was going to become the second Nazi Germany on the world scene. He'd said this Iranian deal is a terrible deal, and that's in quotes, terrible deal, and had really, in 2013, really almost begged President Obama not to do this thing, and that if you allow these mullahs in Iran to get nuclear weapons... I mean, there were 6 million Jews murdered in the Holocaust. There's 6 million Jews living in Israel today. Even just the numbers are chilling to think what Iran, with all their rhetoric about wiping Israel off the map, could do with a weapon like that. And obviously, President Obama did not listen to any of his warnings at the time. So he became he started to become much closer with Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu in the years after that. And even just last year when Netanyahu gave his speech to Congress warning against the nuclear ideal, they had Elie Wiesel there as a guest of honor sitting next to him, just quite literally showing that I'm right beside you and warning the world that this is terrible. And this is even one, this is a quote from Benjamin Netanyahu during that speech, giving testament to Mr. Wiesel. He said, "I wish I could promise you, Elie, that the lessons of history have been learned. I can only urge the leaders of the world not to repeat the mistakes of the past." And he introduced him as a Holocaust survivor who would immortalize the phrase "never again," showing that if we want to make sure that this never happens again, giving these mullahs in Iran is a terrible idea.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about Romanian-born Jewish Nobel laureate, Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel, who died this past Saturday. Thanks, Andrew.
It's time for today's last word.
If you are a parent with children living under your roof, then you are responsible before God for their spiritual education. And that responsibility comes with the opportunity to instruct from the Bible. If you study the book of Deuteronomy, you see Moses felt a similar responsibility to build the families of Israel. This was his final instruction to God's people just before he died and they entered the promised land. He repeatedly emphasized parents' duty to pass spiritual wisdom to their children and grandchildren. Deuteronomy 6 says, "And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up." Surely Moses had witnessed a lot of failure among Israel's families, and you can sense his urgency. Commit these words to heart, then teach them diligently to your children. Discuss them at every opportunity. This is how to survive as a nation. Moses did more than command family Bible studies. He emphasized the importance of reinforcing those Bible lessons throughout the day, at home and away. He expected parents and children to be interacting often and for the Bible to be a regular topic of discussion. He stressed the need for instructing each night before bedtime and again each morning. Moses followed up with very practical instruction. He said, "Write out certain scriptures and principles, post them in the house, help internalize them." Spend some time taking these scriptures to heart, even committing yourself to them in prayer before God. Life can be a jungle of duties and distractions, and we might agree with Moses' statements in principle, but then struggle to implement them. We may make an effort, but lack the consistency these scriptures demand. The mention of diligence and repetition are aimed directly at countering our natural tendency to allow this duty to slip. Consider the rewards of making family Bible instruction the priority God intends. Moses himself described the rich blessings these studies and discussions would bring, including a better relationship with God, stronger families, longer, more abundant life for ourselves, for our children and grandchildren. Every parent wants a close bond with his children. Quality family Bible study and discussion is a key to achieving that. Parent to child, grandparent to child, spiritual instruction. This is glue that binds generation to generation. It's a powerful antidote to the poisonous influences of the world that aim to tear children away from their parents. And even more, obedience to this command welds individual families into a single nation under God. Moses showed that it does nothing less than ensure long-lasting national stability and guarantees a future as a godly nation. Just think about those promises that he made in conjunction with Proverbs 22 and verse 6, which says, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." It's an incredible promise in these scriptures. If parents in Israel had diligently followed the command to teach their children, the nation never would have departed from God's way. And really, there are many, many problems in our nation because people are ignoring these basic commands. But we do not have to do that. Let's learn from this failure and heed the urgent plea from this great God-inspired man and make sure we're rearing our children to know and to love the Bible. The idea of expounding on the scriptures for your family, this may seem very daunting, but here are a few simple points that'll help you move from agreeing in principle with this biblical command to actually making it a part of your family's regular routine. First, you yourself have to be excited about the Bible. You've got to love His Word and be stirred and moved about your own Bible study. How much do you know about the Bible? Get accustomed to searching the Scriptures for answers to the problems you face. Think about what you read. Relate the Bible verses to real-life situations. And as you build excitement in your personal study, your eagerness to pass it on to your children is going to grow. As far as what to study, there are a lot of high-quality youth Bible-based books to read to your children. You can go to www.pcog.org to the youth section. I do that with my kids quite a lot and read articles to them from there. But you can also read straight from the Bible. You might go somewhat methodically through a portion of the Bible, like the Proverbs or the Gospels. Adapt your study at times according to your family's specific needs at that time. You might want to choose a particular theme for a week and give several related studies hitting that topic from various angles. Try to make God real to your children. Talk about God's qualities of character. Get into the details of His miracles. Read to them about His mighty acts. Now, each specific study may only involve one verse or maybe two or three verses. You can rephrase it and in plain terms explain it, making it very practical and show how that links to real life examples. Be creative in getting the concepts across. Make it fun, make it exciting, and be sure that the children understand. Ask them questions, have them think of examples of their own, and encourage them to link the principles that you're reading about to their own daily lives. The more practical and understandable the teaching is, the easier it will be to reinforce it in discussion. And don't go on for too long. Depending on your children's age and attention span, you might go for 5 minutes, maybe up to 20 minutes or so. But work to hold their interest and keep it a positive experience. Praise them as they progress. Ensure that the overall feeling is that studying the Bible is enjoyable and that God's way is great. Moses' command is really a positive command, that we share our spiritual riches with our children. Deuteronomy 6 and other related scriptures really embody a way of life, a way that pulsates with life and with robust interactions between generations. Family Bible studies require diligent effort, but the blessings they produce are well worth it. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Richard Palmer, Robert Morley, Anthony Chibatadwe, and Andrew Miller. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. I'll leave you with this thought from Frederick Douglass. It's easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.